Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Dos Vatos Locos y Poética. It's about a poetry event that's coming up, and we'll be joined by Maria Cristina Lopez from Somos Un Pueblo Unido. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Bill Plimpton. He is an animator and filmmaker, and his feature-length film, Idiots and Angels, screens this weekend, Friday and Saturday, December 17th and 18th, at the Guild Cinema in Albuquerque. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm very delighted to be here. Thanks for calling.
So this is hand-drawn animation. I guess that's kind of an increasingly uncommon art form, particularly in a feature-length film. And I love and have always loved hand-drawn animation. It feels so intimate in its kind of, I guess you would say, loving focus on details. Tell us about the process of making a film, a feature-length film, that is drawn. I mean, do you draw 25 frames per second by hand?
Well, I grew up as an illustrator, and for 15 years I did cartoons for and illustrations for national magazines like Playboy and National Lampoon and New York Times, places like that. So that's where I come from. I love hand drawing. If I were to do it with a computer animation, it would be 1,000 times more expensive and take 4 years longer, and I just don't have the time or the money to do it. And quite frankly, I prefer the look of hand-drawn animation. It has more warmth to it. It feels like it was made by a human being. It feels, you can see the texture in Idiots and Angels. It's really deep because I layer the drawings. Every drawing, there's about 30,000 drawings I did myself, and I liked really getting into the texture of the art and erasing and redrawing and covering it over. So it's quite a amazing spectacle to see something like that. It's a very unique film. It's a very different film than any other film out there, even the hand-drawn films like all the Japanese stuff. So I think the viewers will really be rewarded by checking it out. And not only just visually, but I think in terms of the story, it's quite refreshing. It's very different. It's different than what I usually do. I usually do a lot of gags and sex and violence, but this one has a lot more character development, a plot, a story. It's more focused on one guy who wakes up one morning with wings on his back, and he doesn't like the wings because it makes him do good things, and he wants to do evil things. So it really is a very a kind of a morality tale, really. And although I don't like to tell morals, but it's, my folks actually thought it was quite a spiritual film. So it's a real jump in advancement for my usual stuff.
And ladies and gentlemen, lest you think it is sappy in any way, it is kind of sick and twisted and funny and weird in a good way.
There's some strange things that happened to the guy. Yes, very bizarre things.
Yeah, it's quite wonderful. I have to just say as an aside, I saw your film, I Married a Strange Person, many years ago, and ended up buying the DVD of it and have watched it many, many times. And that's also, I mean, in a different way, kind of sick and twisted and fabulous and hilarious.
Yeah,
and
it's definitely my most bizarre film. I think Idiots and Angels is a step up. People say that I'm starting to mature. I don't know if that's true or not. I hope not, actually. But it is a lot more sophisticated film, and a lot people of all ages like it. I mean, older folks like it, and different kind of strata of society love it. I mean, it's a very universal film.
As I was watching it, I noticed simultaneously the drawing and the story. I mean, as if you watch a hand-drawn animated movie, you cannot help but watch the lines of the drawing and the, you know, the drops of water shooting at you and all the different details that you choose to kind of focus on and exaggerate, and of course the story. And then I began to realize that the sound is also incredibly well crafted, both the music, and there's no real dialogue in the film, but there's a lot of different kinds of music and a lot of nonverbal sounds and human sounds. Tell us about the process of integrating the music with the film.
Well, I've never done a feature-length film without dialogue before. I've done a number of shorts. All the dog shorts are without dialogue, and a few of my other shorts have no dialogue. So I thought it'd be a real wonderful challenge to try and make this feature film without any dialogue. And so consequently, I was forced to use the music as a replacement for dialogue, and I was very lucky to get some wonderful musicians. We have Pink Martini, Nicole Renaud, Larry Campbell does pedal steel for a couple songs, and then, of course, Tom Waits. And Tom was really supportive of this project. Can I tell you the story of how I got Tom involved?
Please do.
While I was doing the drawing, a lot of the film takes place in a bar, a CD bar, so I thought it was appropriate to listen to Tom Waits' music. And the more I listened to it, I just felt like I had to have one of his songs in my film. So I don't know Tom Waits, never met him, but I do know Jim Jarmusch, so I sent Jim a copy of the rough cut of the film and said, if he liked it, pass it on to Tom Waits. And I didn't hear from anybody for about a month, so I was kind of sad. And then I got an email from Tom's wife saying Tom loves the film, and I can have any song I want from his library, you know, with minimal cost, which is awful nice of him, because yeah, usually he charges $20,000-$30,000 for one of his songs for a film, right. Maybe more, I don't know. So I really feel that's the way, the kind of guy he is. He's very supportive of other artists, you know, struggling to do something different, something out of the normal Hollywood mold. And he wants to support them, and I think that's very cool that he does that. So I used two Tom Waits songs in there, and they're really very powerful music.
I think that Tom Waits' generosity that you just mentioned in that story speaks also to the fact that what you're doing is really an uncommon and very precious and valuable genre of art. And I was wondering how you, in your life, have balanced your commercial work, which of course mm-hmm. pays the bills, and your artwork. I mean, there's that famous story about how you refused an offer from Walt Disney.
Yeah, a long time ago, the Disney company offered me $1 million to work for them, and for a number of reasons, I was forced to turn it down, which is I was very reluctant to do because it was my childhood dream to work for Disney, and I still love Disney films. I think Tangled is a wonderful film. But to answer your question about how I pay my bills, actually the short films are quite successful. I make good money on that. The features are now starting to bring in money. In fact, Idiots and Angels is my most successful feature film, and it's doing quite well. And I do occasionally do some commercial stuff. In fact, right now I'm working on a brand new Weird Al Yankovic music video. And I'm also working on some animation for a John Leguizamo feature film called Fugly. But those are few and far between, and quite frankly, the feature films and the shorts pay pretty well. So, you know, it's sort of a cliche in the business that you can't make money on short films, and I think that's totally wrong. I think if you make a film that is funny and short and not so expensive, it's very easy to make a profit and continue making films. I've made about 40 short films so far in my career, and they've all pretty much been profitable. I think there's a lot of places to sell these films.
Very interesting. You were showing this film, Idiots and Angels, along with a newer short called The Cow Who Wanted to Be a Hamburger. It's a short mm-hmm. animation. It's terrific. They also sent me that. I love it.
Good.
Is this a... I have to ask, is this a parable about military recruiting?
You know, there's a lot of issues that are in the film. Just for your listeners, let me describe it. It was inspired by a trip I was taking to Oregon. I'm from Oregon originally. I live in New York now, actually. But I saw these cows eating in a pasture, and they seemed so obsessed by eating as much grass as possible, like they were trying to make themselves the perfect steak. And I had the bright idea, oh, a cow who wanted to be a hamburger. And so it's a very different look. It's a very different technique. It's a Sharpie on paper and then colored digitally. And it's very childlike. It's very bright colors and kind of like a children's book. But the issues that are covered in the film are there's the vegetarianism, you know, eating meat issue, the power of advertising, how sometimes advertising makes you want something very badly and you realize eventually that you really don't want that thing. And then also the power of a mother's love. So there's a lot of really interesting issues. The military, I never had that in the back of my mind, but now that you mention it, I see where you're coming from, and I suppose that that will work that way.
The hand-drawn animation that you do, I used to watch those annual animation festivals. There would be these feature-length or longer festivals with anything from 3 minute to longer short animated pieces, and at least when I started watching those kinds of festivals in the 80s, there was quite a bit of hand-drawn animation.
Yes.
A lot of it from Canada, because I guess they support their animators. What about now? Is there a new generation of people who do what you're doing?
There are, but quite frankly, it's not as prevalent as it was back in the 80s. Before the computer took over. And I understand that. I mean, if I was a young animator in school, I'd probably learn how to do computer animation simply because that's where most of the jobs are, you know, with Flash and computer games and, of course, Pixar and commercials. There's a lot of work for anybody who knows how to animate with a computer. But I really believe that you got to have good drawing skills. You can't just be good with a computer. You have to be able to tell a good story, timing, character design, analyze movement. So it's really it's possible for someone to do traditional animation like I do to make good money. And like I said before, it's easy to sell something if it's something that the audience really loves to look at. Don Hertzfeld's another guy who actually does quite well with hand-drawn animation, and his shorts are very successful. He makes good money from his animation.
When I was watching the editing, I wondered, do you, like in a film, you shoot more footage than you need and then edit in, you know, a live-action movie. Do you do that also in an animated movie?
Yeah, there was a sequence in Idiots and Angels that is where he goes into a bar and he starts going crazy and he starts fantasizing about all these strange things that happen in a bar. And there is, the scene is still in the film, but it went on a little too long, a little too crazy. Believe it or not, I cut it out. I know that sounds hard to believe that I would cut out a surreal, crazy scene in my film. But I just felt it took away from the story. And so I did edit that shot out, but most everything else, I think, 98% of everything I drew is in the film. So there is not a lot of editing like a documentary or a live-action film. Speaking of documentary, there is someone making a documentary about me now. It's called Adventures in Plimtoons. It should be out sometime this summer. Alexia Anastasia is making the documentary, and so we're going to send it out on the festival circuit. So hopefully it'll play down there sometime this spring. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, let's see if we can get it in Santa Fe. You also have on your website, plimptoons.com, thing called the Anacam.
Anacam, that's been shelved, quite frankly, for a number of reasons. One is I've been traveling so much now, and I've been doing so much business work, contracts and telephone calls and emails, and I just haven't had time to do a lot of drawing on my office drawing board. So quite frankly, people would be bored to death if they checked it out. But for about 4 or 5 years ago, we had the Anacam going, and it was very popular. People all over the world could watch me draw this animated feature every day. So it was very exciting. But you can get it. The Hair High, my new DVD feature film, has a bunch of the Anacam on that. So if people want to check it out, it is
available.
Well,
there's also archived footage on Plimptoons.
Yeah,
so
can see it on
Plimptoons.
So I was
watching that, yeah.
Yeah, but it looks like I'm drawing really fast, but I think we sped it up. I don't think I draw that fast.
It's time-lapse. That's what's great about it. It's I mean, for those non-artists among us, it's utterly fascinating to watch people do this. But anyway, we're talking to Bill Plimpton, animator and filmmaker, and his feature-length film, Idiots and Angels, screens at the Guild Cinema in Albuquerque this Friday and Saturday, December 17th and 18th, along with his short film, The Cow Who Wanted to Be a Hamburger. And for our Albuquerque listeners, check it out. And those who aren't able to make it, you can buy many of the films of Bill Plimpton's films on DVD on plimptoons.com, P-L-Y-M-P-T-O-O-N-S. And so thank you, Bill Plimpton, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Yes, they make great Christmas gifts. If anybody wants, is looking for a very different Christmas gift, check out the Plimptoons website.
And I have to say, I'm thinking about giving Idiots and Angels to a young person, but don't give I Married a Strange Person to any children.
Yeah. That gets very graphic, yeah. There is one mild scene in Idiots and Angels where I think you see a breast for about three frames. But other than that, it's pretty mild stuff.
Bill Plimpton, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for calling, and I hope people go see the film and tell their friends.
Excellent. And this segment, we are talking about Dos Vatos Locos y Poética. It is an event, a potluck with poets and open mic that's happening this coming Saturday, the 18th of December in Chupadero. I'd like to welcome Paul White. He is the organizer of this open mic potluck event, and Israel Aros and John Davis and poet Chuck Calabrese will be joining us in just a few minutes. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello.
Hi.
So, Paul, tell us about this Poetry at Paul's potluck poet. That's a lot of P's. potluck poetry stuff. You do basically poetry events at your house in Chupadero?
Yes, I've been doing them for the last 8 years or so. I started them with a poet who was in the Santa Fe area, Gary Glazner. And originally I saw Gary doing a series similar to what he helped me set up at the Inn at the Alameda. And I was very impressed with the poets that I saw there and the venue, and I wanted to do something like that in my own home.
So what is it that makes it what it is? Not only the reading, but the ability to socialize, or?
Yeah, there's a potluck, and then there's the featured poets and an open mic, and it's generally it's a really nice crowd of people, poets, writers, poetry appreciators. You don't have to be a poet to come, and people get to meet book publishers there and learn about other poetry events.
John Davis, you are not only a poet in your own right, and we had a wonderful program not too long ago in which we talked about one of your latest books, but you also are the inventor
manager
of a lot of other poets.
That's true.
How does that work?
That all began when I discovered a poet named Fernando Pessoa, the Portuguese poet, who was not only probably Portugal's most famous poet during his lifetime, but he was also six other well-known poets. He wrote as what he called heteronyms. And if you read the accounts of his heteronyms, he was overcome by these personalities. He didn't plan it, usually, according to him. And then he would start writing in these other voices, and some wrote in English, and some wrote in Portuguese, one wrote in Latin. They're still trying to figure out exactly how many poets he was after he died. He left these papers, and
Did people think it was different people?
It's hard to say. Yeah, the accounts aren't very clear on that.
But in other words, in the anthologies of Portuguese poetry, do you have some of his heteronyms listed?
Yeah, you have them, yeah. And they started movements and argued with each other in print, and it was a whole world he created.
And so you're doing the same thing.
Yeah, I hadn't planned on it either, but I have been for... I've kind of narrowed it down to three or four now, but there have been about 20 different characters that I write as and publish as.
The whole question of artistic inspiration is something that we've talked about on this program many times and that you can talk about until the end of time, but this thing of letting poems, letting art, letting music flow through you and being more like the facilitator than the inventor of this, when you're not you, but you're Chuck Calabrese or one of these other people, does the process work that way also?
Yes. For example, if I'm going to be Chuck, there's a... I mean, sometimes I decide to be Chuck. Sometimes I start writing and I notice that I am Chuck this day. And it's a different way of writing, a different way of approaching the sounds of the poem. So they unfold in an entirely different way. Rarely is he entirely serious about anything. And if he is, I usually take that poem back. And there's probably four poems in my book that Chuck actually wrote in a somber mood. So I took those back.
It must give you a certain kind of freedom to be able to do that, because they can, Chuck or whoever, can write really outrageous things, and it's not really John Davis who's going to take the brunt of it.
I haven't been held responsible for anything yet. it's not me. He's a different person. He's a totally different set of values. Not totally different, but largely different. And the same with other characters. You know, they have different emotional tendencies, different set of values, different ways with language. So
different genders.
Different genders, yeah.
Races, the whole thing.
Everything, yeah. So that's what I did.
How is this,
that's
in your
do.
View? Yeah, that's
what
the all. Well, and so it sort of, I mean, it makes one wonder, how is this like and not like multiple personality disorder? I guess it's not a disorder.
I can control it, I think, so far. We'll see.
It's not a problem, in other words.
Right, yeah, I'm not being treated for it now.
We're talking to John Davis. Chuck Calabrese is going to join us in just a few minutes. Anything else that you want to say about Chuck as a kind of introduction before we meet him?
I think Chuck will speak for himself.
Well, while Chuck is getting ready and John goes to tie up and take care of his pit bull, why don't we turn to Israel Aros, who will... Would you like to start straight in by reading some of your poetry?
Sure. To help me off guard with that, but... And kind of to add to what I'm realizing as John speaking, oh, hey... I have the same disorders, but for me, it's also a gesture to my community back in East Los Angeles to not only use forms like spoken word form or popular form, but really try to venture off of different forms. So there's always different cadences, and I notice, okay, this is a totally different mindset coming in right now, you know, and watching those different cadences. So this first one is about Facebook. It's called Facebooked. I thought these were real things on Facebook. A friend and heart-shaped boxes. Collections of sage and chocolate on my wall. A video kiss. A poem sleeping into your computer RAM. Another note seen into your wasted computer eyes. My screen goes blank with you. You, the one that never reads any of this. Because you're my friend, Keno. Mary Charlotte, aren't you my friend? Didn't I meet you here by fate, by destiny? Didn't I interact the most I've ever interacted with anybody through this interface? Through this faceless wall, through our metaphysical chat, didn't we form our bond in the universe? Isn't this why they made this thing? So we could become real friends? Oh, do I want to get together for coffee? I really can't meet you for café. I have to meet up with Emiliano Zapato's long-lost cousin tonight. I have a Facebook date with him around noonish till midnightish or so. We're gonna plot a totally revamped evolutionary tortilla y frijoles marketing campaign to save the barrio. And we'll run for president at our local cultural y café con leche center. It will be the model for the next 7 generations to follow. I'll post it on your wall later, Mary. But I gotta go now. I love you.
Israel Aros. Gee, without even knowing me, you put my name in. That's wonderful. Now, you're from Mexico or you're from East LA?
I'm from East Los Angeles, which sometimes gets referred to as Little Mexico.
And so you write in English, Spanish, Spanglish, kind of moving easily mm-hmm. from one language to the other and being very creative within that.
Yeah, and also Nahuatl and some Lakota, picking up again on the cadences of the neighborhood, you know, and how you grow up and how you talk in one space and the next space. You know, when you're inside a classroom, you're taught formal English. When you're outside, you have another code. So it's code switching. But ultimately, like I said, when I was talking about being able to give that back to my community, that you don't have to sacrifice one over the other, that it's all part of your musical ensemble.
What is the poetry scene like where you're from?
It gets mixed reviews, as everywhere I go, because I tend not to be inside of one genre or one way of looking at the world, because although I grew up in East Los Angeles, I've had the privilege, which very few get, to be able to venture off and go to UC Berkeley and venture off and go to, you know, get an MFA program, which was all part of a whole other story. But so because of that, you know, I tend to entertain different languages at different times, different spaces.
When you talk about bringing poetry to your community and doing it in service of your community, I always wonder, how does poetry, in a big way or a small way, affect communities that are dealing with some of the serious social pathogens that we have in this nation?
So right now, with SB 1070, and as I work with the Adelante program, which is homeless youth in Santa Fe. And even in Santa Fe, we're seeing an influx of what's happening with stuff in Arizona. We currently have over 1,100 students registered in our program, some of them coming from that space. And with that, we also have an opportunity to educate other people, because we currently have Fathers in Focus and other people trying to help us do a poetry workshop with these families that we work with every week to illustrate how important it is to tell their stories, especially when you have xenophobia and SB 1070 in effect, and the mayor of Santa Fe saying this can be a refuge. So then we say to those people that come here, speak those stories. And if I don't give them an example of the multitude of ways of how to speak those stories, then they have nothing to go with. Sometimes I use 3 or 4 words in a poem. Sometimes I get, you know, I make up words, you know, to then again say, like, it's all fair game. You know, your literacy, your illiteracy, your what you know is important, valid. Mm-hmm.
There is great importance in telling one's story for the purpose of getting it out, articulating it, having it be heard. And then the next question is, who do you want to hear it? Your family, your community, the mm-hmm. dominant culture that doesn't have any idea and is often, I would say, willfully ignorant of mm-hmm. what is going on, you know, 2 doors down.
Mm-hmm. I said I want everybody to hear the story. And, you know, I have... Sometimes people say, you know, I really like your poems, they're so soft, but then you get, you start talking about the world and politics, and it just doesn't jive with me, you know, and so I always find that like, wow, then I did my job, you know, if I can sneak that in there in a lulled voice or in a funny voice or in a really dramatic voice. Always changing the voice, because my audience is the children and the abuelitas and everybody in between, you know, because the children are going to educate us in the future, so I have to provide something for them. You know, I'll speak the same poem to them, which they'll find really hilarious, because I'm using the word border, border, border over and over, and sticking everything in between, zebras, tortillas, revolution, you know, Juarez, and they're laughing away. And then I'll tell that same poem in a totally different setting, and there's just like, oh, I don't want to hear that, but it's sounding kind of nice. So,
right. Yeah. I think it's, I mean, one of the, I don't have any answers for this, but it's something, because the kind of multicultural movements in which people are trying to get their stories heard, and I mean, Black American literature has been some of the finest literature that our nation has produced for many, many, many decades, going back to the early 20th century, and still to this day, there is this kind of, oh, I don't want to hear it, or that's too rough for me. Mm. I don't know how one addresses that.
I think there's always going to be in that space where people don't want to listen to what's going on, but it's always up to the privilege. That's why I consider myself one of the privileged now, to be able to speak. I'm not middle class, but I have opportunities that are only available to middle class now because of where I work, my degrees, and then being able to provide those same tools to my community. I mentioned earlier, before we were even on the air, that I have a $300 recording device. You know, that's a tool that...
Sitting at this table right now.
Yeah, that most people in my community do not have access to. So I want to be able to give that back to them, but also show them that you don't need those tools. Sometimes I use Sharpies to make these elaborate drawings, and Sharpies is often used in my community to deface property. So I use that very same tool to ignite creation, to ignite change in both the mentality and what can be done. Because a lot of that times when they're defaced, what is considered defacing it, it's an artistic expression. It's not being able to have the voice, the space to do that.
You are both a poet and a visual artist.
Yes.
So Israel Aros is part of Dos Vatos Locos y Poética, which is happening at Poetry at Paul's this Saturday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a potluck. And we are being joined now by Chuck Calabrese. Welcome.
Well, I didn't know I was going to be here, but I guess I'll do what I can.
And where are you from, Chuck?
Well, you know, I'm from just about everywhere. You know, I don't like to reveal my specific location because you don't know who's going to show and knock at your door. If I had a door, they would knock on it.
Would you like to read a poem?
Yeah, let me see here. It is actually, you know, not only am I a poet, but I'm also a journalist, and I write a lot of news, and I recently discovered how Americans like their poetry. I took a survey, and this is how Americans like their poetry. 17% scratched into men's room stall. 8% read to them in monotone by wheezing American lit prof. 14% acted out by hand puppets. 12% recited to them by lariat twirling cowpoke. 9% recited as part of used car pitch. 12% uttered breathlessly at team building workshop. 9% snorted into camera by WWF tag team champs. And 19%, by far the largest percentage, chanted rhythmically by daring, taboo-shattering performance poet Angelique. Angelique's going to be there, isn't she? On Saturday, I think, maybe.
She's coming with you?
Well, she doesn't actually like to be seen with me in public that often.
How did you get into poetry?
The bigger question is how to get out of it, which I haven't figured out yet.
Well, I mean, what's a What's a guy like you doing writing poetry?
I have a lot of time, basically, and a pen, and occasionally some paper.
I read that you're founder of both the Tourette's School of Poetry.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I damn, yeah.
And Chuckismo, exclamation point.
Right, and it's important to note that exclamation point. I wanted to have one on each side, but I couldn't figure out how to do the first one. So, but I think it's the only poetry movement, and if somebody can disagree with me, that actually includes an exclamation point. And that's a marketing tool, of course.
Does the poetry that you write and the performances that you do kind of help you in your relationships with the ladies?
Well, yeah, I am the world's foremost expert on failed relationships, and my poetry goes a long way towards assuring that I continue in that role.
Could you perhaps read a poem that illustrates that dynamic?
I'm writing a book. I don't have it with me, but luckily it's short, and I can probably remember the entire text of it. But I'm writing a book on. It's called Relationship Dynamics for Men, and I thought it was going to be like a big self-help book, like a lot of pages and a kind of a hefty cover price. But it didn't work out that way, so. Basically, now it goes like this. Relationship dynamics for men. It's two words. The first is incommunicative. And that's what when a man won't say what he feels. And the second word is inappropriate. And that's what he is when he does.
We're talking to Chuck Calabrese. What's your relationship to the poet John Davis?
Well, I sometimes appear as John Davis just because he seems to be more popular with a kind of a mainstream poetry thing. And so I sometimes appear as him. It's not very interesting, but it's another gig. And he seems to be very successful, which is a little upsetting to me. But I have my own. What's that French word? Niche. Niche. I have my own niche.
Does he help
you? I don't have a niece, but I have a niche.
Does he help you out?
He will probably, if I'm lucky, give me a ride home today, and that's pretty much all I can expect from him.
So do you always travel with your pit bull?
You heard about my pit bull. I think it's...
John's
holding
it outside the building.
I know, and I wish him luck because it hasn't worked out so well lately. But, every poet ought to have... Israel, do you have a pit bull? Everybody...
No, but you're actually making me think about it. Maybe I should get one. It's good protection.
Yeah, especially if you're going to say anything controversial, and apparently you are, so...
Israel, you've got a... website, waterhummingbirdhouse.wordpress.com. Mm-hmm. What's the significance for you of the hummingbird image?
The hummingbird in Nahuatl is a representation of the sun. So when it represents the sun, that's the winter solstice time. This is just one meaning of it, but what it is the sun is still very powerful, even at that what it's considered the weakest point. Another thing that the hummingbird represents is truth. So that whenever you have a hummingbird visit you, you should really be paying attention as to what you're saying, thinking at that moment in time. Those are just some immediate things that the hummingbird comes to mind as far as... And then the water... You know, there's a lot of talk of oil right now, but the reality is that we're in an era where water is being sold to us, where water rights are being considered, where water is a commodity, and water is life. So we're saying we're charging for life. So those are some of the things that I want people to think about.
And people can find Israel's poetry by, well, going to the website and clicking on the links that I will have on SantaFeRadioCafe.org, but also Googling Water Hummingbird House.
Yeah, and then also on Facebook, again, talking about giving back to my community. over the last 2 years, I've been working on a poetry series called Love in the Time of Obama.
Right. And you can hear some of your work live, which is mm-hmm. great. If people don't make it out to Chupadera, they can still hear you online.
Yeah, and it's intended, again, to give back. And really, it's a manuscript and a work in progress as this time, which is considered a very sacred time, is evolving. And one of the things that my elders told me is that there's seven loves. And all they said to me was that, they just said, there's seven loves. So the work is trying to engage in what that means is community love, partner love, familial love, environmental love. And really, in this time that seems really heavy with war and destruction, it's like, how do I engage in that? I'd say with weapons of mass creation.
Nice.
And try to engage others to do the same when it feels like everything's collapsing.
Paul White, are you a poet also?
No, I'm not a poet.
So you like to just give people a voice in your house.
I very much enjoy poets and poetry, and I like the sort of intimate space that having these events at my house creates. And it's always a good time that we have there. Even though it's a little bit out of town, it's a beautiful drive. It's going to be in the middle of the day around 1 o'clock, starting at 1 o'clock. I also wanted to mention that, about a couple of months, 2 or 3 months ago, I saw Israel and John over at El Farol. Monday nights they have Poetica at El Farol starting at around 7 o'clock, and it's a great venue. And when I was very impressed by both of these poets. I thought they had something in common. I was looking around for John after he did his reading, and I looked back there, and he vanished. And I saw this other guy over there, and he was kind of dressed funny, and he looked a little intimidating, so I didn't want to ask him where John was, but afterwards I kind of put two and two together, and that's when I realized that I had to...
You were dealing with Chuck Calabrese.
Yeah, I had to invite both of them. One doesn't seem to come without the other, so... So that's... I just wanted to let people know about El Farol, Monday nights.
So this is Dos Vatos Locos y Poetica, and it's... If you want to find out the phone number and location, all that kind of stuff, just go to a computer and Google Santa Fe Poetry and Prose, and that is on meetup.com. You can find it there. Just poke around a little bit, or also go to my website, santafe.radiocafe.org. And Israel Aros will also have chapbooks for sale, and the proceeds from those sales will go to the Adelante program for tutoring and eviction prevention. And I want to thank you all, Paul White, Chuck Calabrese, and Israel Aros, and outside the building, John Davis. Great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you.
It was good to be had.
I'd like now to welcome Maria Cristina Lopez. She is with Somos Un Pueblo Unido. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. I'm very happy to be here.
Somos Un Pueblo Unido está celebrando 15 años. They're celebrating 15 years, 15th anniversary, this coming Saturday, the 18th of December, at the New Mexico History Museum with special guest Luis Alberto Urrea, who is the author of a book called The Devil's Highway. We interviewed him several months ago about the wonderful book Into the Beautiful North, and he will actually be coming to Santa Fe again.
Yes, he is. He says he loves Santa Fe, and we love to have him here. He's going to be signing his books at the first part of our celebration, which will be at the History Museum, as you said, from 6 to 7, he'll be signing books. We'll have mariachis in the second lobby of the museum, and people will be able to go to the exhibit, the new exhibit, the Threads
of Memory.
Memory. Lo estoy pensando en español. Hilo de la memoria is in Spanish. And so if you want to go meet him and have your book signed or buy a book, because Allá bookstore will be selling his books from 6 to 7.
And then a dinner.
and then a dinner. And at the dinner, we'll have music, awards, and Luis is going to speak for about half an hour. He's going to be talking to our audience.
Now, Somos Un Pueblo Unido is a group that has been advocating for the rights of immigrants in the United States, particularly in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
What are you working on now?
Now we're working, well, there's so much that Somos is working on. Two specific things are workers' rights, and the other one is making our county jails not allow ICE to just walk in and arrest people and deport them. Making, ensuring that our county jails do that. And in fact, our Santa Fe County Jail has done that, has said to ICE, if you have to come for somebody, bring us a name and you can take them, but you cannot just come in here and take people
out. So basically they have to follow procedure and the rule of law.
Exactly. And they weren't doing it. And they don't do it in most jails. They intimidate people. So that our director of our county jail is getting an award from us because she stood up to ICE and asked them to do that. And they said, but, you know, we are federal agents. And she said, follow procedure. So she, in a way, protected the rights of immigrants who are in jail for sometimes traffic violations and very minor things. And that's who has to be protected. Another thing that we're doing is we're starting to work to protect what we already have, which is our driver's licenses.
Right, and that is an issue. I find it a fascinating issue because it's basically if people have credentials from their home country, they can get a driver's license in New Mexico, which means that they can drive their cars to and from work and have insurance. And what's so interesting to me about that law is that law enforcement and the insurance industry, which not that party politics are meaningful and the way those lines are drawn is meaningful, but those tend to be perhaps more conservative groups. They were very much in favor of it.
Yes, they are. Law enforcement, especially, for two reasons. One, the idea of the safety of the community in large. But the second one is that it's driver's licenses is the best way to identify people.
Right.
And so if you want to know who's here, and if you want to find them, you do it by driver's licenses. So, yes, they do. And another thing that happens to it with our law here is that people have to get an ETIN, an ITIN, which is a number that the federal government gives you if you want to pay taxes.
Right, a tax identification number.
Exactly. And if you don't have a Social Security number, you can get a tax identification number and pay your taxes. So all the people who have gotten licenses without Social Security are paying taxes in the state and into the federal government. So money's coming in, apart from all the money that our community spends, in buying groceries, gifts for Christmas,
right,
cars, everything else.
Mm-hmm. Well, much more to talk about, but Somos Un Pueblo Unido is celebrating its 15th year anniversary, once again this Saturday, the 18th of December, at 6 o'clock in the evening, reception from 6 to 7, dinner from 7 to 9, with the wonderful, wonderful author, Luis Alberto Urrea. If you haven't read Into the Beautiful North, mm-hmm, consider buying yourself a Christmas gift or somebody else of that book. Maria Cristina Lopez, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for inviting us, and we invite the community to come and join us this Saturday at the History Museum.
And SomosUnPuebloUnido.org is the website, and the telephone number is 505-424-7832.
Yes.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.